I am Allegra Stratton.
And I'm Tom Clark.
And this is Guardian's Politics Weekly, though with the pace of events this week, we're thinking of bringing in a Politics Daily and possibly even a Politics Hourly.
This week we went back to the 17th century, the first Speaker ousted from the Commons in 300 years and the first Peers kicked out of the Lords for just as long. We'll ask whether a constitutional revolution is in the air.
Or just a general election. Gordon Brown said this week that David Cameron's idea of an election would cause chaos. Did he just mean that Labour would lose? Is it time for politicians to meet the people?
With Esther Ranson threatening to run for Parliament, we'll ask whether Britain is ready for a new breed of celebrity politicians with lily-white consciences and hearts of gold.
Mm. In the pod right now, we have a very late Jonathan Friedland. We have Polly Toynbee and we have Jenny Russell with their notepads bulging with lists of constitutional reforms they want. Polly, go on, go for it.
What I would go for first is proportional representation. Blow fresh air into the Commons. Allow new parties to develop. People are deeply, have been for a very long time.
How long have you been writing that you want this?
Oh, I don't know, forever. As long as I've ever been writing, I think.
And how much more likely do you think it is this week?
I think it's moved a whole step closer because I think there's such dislike of both Labour and Conservative Party and the idea that they've got a complete stranglehold and nobody can start a new movement and get new MPs into the Commons. I think people are outraged by that. Whether the Commons Gentlemen's Club will close ranks and prevent anybody else getting in there, I don't know. But it's for the people to make enough noise.
Jenny, your heart's desire.
The things that I would really like to see in the Commons is a removal of the power and bullying of the whips and the party hierarchy. I think the fact that MPs walk through lobbies like sheep and are terrified of ever speaking out against the government because they are worried about future ministerial careers and placed on select committees is one of the reasons that the Commons in the disastrous state it is.
Johnny?
Well, I would pick PR pretty high up too, and I'm a late convert to that too. It was the 2005 election, actually, that really finally did it for me, the notion that you could have just a quarter of the votes and yet form a almost landslide majority government seems to me just so unjust that things have to change. The other reason why perhaps it should come first is because it's the one reform which would unlock the rest, because through that mechanism and the government that would come out, you would be able to pass all kinds of things that are currently blocked. But the main thing, and I think it addresses what Jenny's saying about everyone's against these party managers and controls. Mm. You always are going to get that if the government dominates in the Commons, and the government, by definition, does dominate the Commons, otherwise they wouldn't be the government. So what we need to do is what actually other countries did hundreds of years ago, which is a separation of powers, executive in one place, the government, and the legislature, the lawmaking body, in some other place where they can be fully independent, no whips, no even hope of a job in the executive. That's quite complicated to do it. You could do it under PR. You may end up having to just look to the second chamber to keep that completely free of the executive. And if you did that, you obviously have to elect it. So this is big stuff.
One of the pitfalls always raised about PR is that it does end up breaking the constituency link, doesn't it? Does that matter?
I think
the constituency link is a bit of a myth.
Then you wouldn't have all these second homes.
Well, indeed, you wouldn't. MPs love to think that their constituents love them, but virtually all of them are swept in and out of power according to the national swing. Very few MPs are there on their own qualities, good ones and bad ones alike.
Polly, they do have to go and meet people in their constituents on a Friday afternoon, which is a kind of common sense check.
They'd still have to, because if you had, say, a multi-member constituency, say six of them, each of them would have a chunk of the place to conduct their surgeries in. But the great advantage is if you'd voted Labour, you could go to a Labour MP that you had voted for, who you agreed with for help. And if you were a Tory, you could go to a Tory. At the moment, you know, if you live on an estate, you're not very keen to go to some grandee with an estate of his own to talk about your benefit problem.
I slightly disagree with Polly on this, only in that I think that it's interesting that in all the debate about MPs, one of the things that people do say online is, but my local MP has been fantastic when I've gone to him for problems about immigration or drains or my mother not getting a flat. But I think one of the ways that you could solve that is one of the other reforms that ought to take place, which is much more devolution of power to local councils. And then you would have local councillors being important people in their local areas because they would have the kind of authority that MPs don't have. And that means transferring real power, including financial authority, down to local councils instead of keeping so much of it at Westminster.
Well, on Monday we had quite an electric moment in the House of Commons. We're just going to play a clip of some of the exchanges.
A point of order, Mr. Prentice.
A motion of no confidence in you, sir, will appear on the order paper tomorrow. Am I right in thinking it will be debated tomorrow and voted upon?
No, order, this is not a point of order. Order, please allow me to answer. Please allow me to answer. These are matters for debate on an appropriate motion. Mr. Caswell.
On a point of order, as you'll be aware, members on all sides have now tabled a substantive motion calling for a vote of no confidence in you. When will members be allowed to choose a new speaker with the moral authority to clean up Westminster and the legitimacy to lift this House out of the mire?
I know that the Honourable Member has taken... I'll answer. I know the Honourable Gentleman has taken advice. It's not a substantive motion. It's an early day motion. The Honourable Gentleman is telling me it's not. Please give me the credit for having some experience in the chair. It's not a substantive motion. It is an early day motion. And the Honourable Gentleman knows...
That was the sound of Michael Martin sticking to his guns. Just 24 hours later, he went back to the House to tell MPs he was stepping down. Jenny, isn't he just a scapegoat being slaughtered for all of their sins?
Well, he's not just a scapegoat. Talking to people who were heavily involved in trying to get Parliament to reform itself a few years ago, many of whom wanted to remain anonymous, they said that the Speaker was absolutely part of the whole bullying system of the Fees Office, and he was at the top of it. But there are an awful lot of other people who bear responsibility. The members of the Standards and Privileges Committee, for instance, who refused to allow Elizabeth Filkin to get the information that she wanted out of the Fees Office and the Labour Party in order for her to investigate what was really going on with MPs' expenses. There were a whole crowd of people who were just determined that they were going to keep their privileges and nobody was going to be allowed to inspect them.
Polly, do you think the severing of this one head will make any difference?
I think it was absolutely essential, but it's only a small first step. I think when people saw the kind of flummery that was surrounded everything to do with the Speaker, the ludicrous clothes he wears, and then this extraordinary exaggerated respect, and nobody should ever criticise the Speaker, you think, hang on a minute, everybody can see the Speaker's a dud and has been an obstacle to all reform of any kind, and particularly has been a sort of shroud to cover up the expenses scandal, has tried his hardest, gone to law even, with using a lot of our money to do it. He had to go.
But if we have open season on the Speaker from now on, isn't it going to be like in America where it becomes a very kind of partisan, an opinionated figure rather than a kind of haughty chair? And would that matter?
I think it would matter, but if you have somebody who genuinely has the respect of the House, but the idea that they're never removable, however bad they are, I mean, I think they do have to watch it and make sure that not just the interests of the members, but, you know, the public interest, they take into account as well.
We had 9 MPs, I think, standing up and attacking the Speaker, saying to his face, basically saying to your boss, you're crap. Mm. That's Parliament being strong, isn't it? Is it really a very bad week for Parliament? Were there moments of game-changing events?
Well, it's good. It's healthy in a way. It just shows that change is possible. That's very important because sometimes our system is so paralysed by tradition that you believe nothing can ever happen and change is always impossible.
Were you shocked when you watched those clips?
Shocking because people very rarely break from the procedure. But the very notion that he was untouchable did go to this notion. I mean, I was writing about it this week that what is sacred and paramount above all other things is Parliament rather than actually the
Parliament,
people of the country.
Parliament, as they pronounce it.
I know. I mean, and I do think this has exposed something about that parliamentary sovereignty. Well, actually, that doesn't speak to people in the country. They think we should be sovereign, and so the notion that he has some elevated role beyond reach of the people is ridiculous, really. And it's good that it's been taken down.
Okay. So how much is he a public figure, and how much is his going to penetrate the dog and duck, the proverbial...
Well, it's only if it's a start. I mean, if people think they have dumped everything onto him and said he's the bad guy, everyone just knows he's clearly not the guy who, charged for his moat and his duck floating duck island, etc.
He cannot be charged for her taxis.
He became absolutely emblematic of it. He was guilty of the secrecy, trying to, as Polly said, go to court. He was guilty of the profligacy. It means £4,000 on taxis. Mm. And also the whole... Oh, and the flummery and mystique. So he's absolutely a good personification of the problem of Parliament. But, you know, I mean, the sentence of this whole affair that still stays in my mind is Anthony Steen saying, and it's found out that he's been charging huge amounts for his country estate, comes out and says, you're absolutely right, it is a terrible system. And we think, no, it's not a lousy system. And we're saying, you know, it's not our problem, it's not wholly just the system, it's the fact that you played the system. No one made them do that. So Martin can bear some responsibility for the system, but the fact that one after another were lining up to play the system, they have to take responsibility for that. That has to be at the ballot box and beyond.
You're looking very depressed, Polly.
Well, it's interesting because you get the social class angle where Cameron is plainly very, very jumpy at grandees with moats and ducks, what really worries him. So it's off with their heads as soon as it got moats and ducks. Whereas Labour, it's all about mortgages, more mundane things. People things people understand better. Somebody fiddling on their mortgage is very close to home because they're not mega rich on the whole, most Labour people. So, and yet in some ways, that makes people even angrier. They've sort of known that the Tory grandees have lived in another universe and they're weird and they've got knighthoods for some reason just for having moats, I think.
So castle keeping.
Yes, exactly. I think in a way, people who voted Conservative have always maybe even quite liked it, whereas Labour people are profoundly shocked at their own members fiddling ordinary things like mortgages that they're struggling with themselves.
I think the Tory grandee thing is a fascinating question. It's one of the things in politics I still don't know where the country is going to be on this, which is this thing of class. We know the failure of the Toff campaign in the Crewe and Nantwich by-election, and I thought that Boris Johnson's class would be a factor in London. It seems as if it wasn't. I think it will be shocking to a lot of voters who see Cameron front of house, who's done quite a good job of seeming modern and very Bowdoin catalogue and just different, and then seeing all these Tories
out
there, does it remind them that, oh my word, there really are a whole lot of these Tory grandees of these huge estates? That's the real Conservative Party. Or do they, and I slightly fear this is how Cameron has been so successful, think that is some other alien party that's not really to do with him? I mean, his skill in severing them at their head so quickly has almost managed to make it seem as if they're a separate group, nothing
Johnny,
to do with him.
And
I think that's
he
has got away with it, which I think is remarkable.
How has he got away with his own wisteria on his chimney? £680 to have wisteria taken off. And also, when you see his house, a vast
which he's paid
house.
Back.
And huge claims for a mortgage on a much too big house. It's yet somehow he's walked away clean as clean. I think perhaps if you knock off other people's heads fast enough and loud enough, people don't look at you so much.
And seem decisive. I mean, that is obviously the opportunity he's seized here. And it does pain me when you watch Brown, who could have easily scored, you know, it's a crude business politics in a way. He could have scored machismo points just by cutting people off straight away. If Hazel Blears's conduct is totally unacceptable, how does he accept her as a cabinet minister?
That's right, because we were talking beforehand about you know what it would have been like with Blair in charge. Being terrible. Because I can't remember what he's been accused of, but we know this month
he mortgaged a house for 10 times more than he bought it for in the first time.
So that we would be paying off his
claimed a large chunk of the interest and used the money to buy that big house in Connell Square, didn't he?
Now, one of the things that really troubles me about this is who on earth gave authority for all Blair's receipts to be shredded? You know, why can we not get access to them?
Have they been shredded?
They've all been shredded. That's why we don't hear anything about it. But why on earth did that happen and who decided it?
Okay,
I think it's very scandalous.
The task in hand is who to replace Michael Martin. Johnny, who would you like?
I mean, I find this whole game in stocks in John Bercow, I find interesting. Obviously, his image inside Parliament has changed. I think outside people can't see him as a future Speaker. The one thing I was slightly surprised by was how quickly Alan Beath's, from the Lib Dems, Alan Beath, rather than major pressure on Vince Cable, the one politician in the country who has high standing and respect is Vince Cable.
That would be a big waste.
After all, the Speaker is a pretty dull job most of the time.
But it's the whole problem.
If it's a reforming Speaker and drives through this programme of reform.
There's a limit to what the Speaker can do. The Speaker cannot stand in the way of reform and can encourage it, but in the end, it's the parties themselves, as they stand now, who have to get a grip on this.
So
and
who's
I think
your
it'd be
pick,
a waste.
Polly?
Well, I think that the idea of Damien Green's not a bad one. I think he commands quite a lot of respect, and I think I'd go for him. I think he probably has to be a Tory this time. I think Sir George Young's not a bad stick. He's another of these grandees, but quite a decent one. He's only black mark against him is he privatised the railways.
Small
have we seen his expenses, Georgia? Are they okay?
Well, they haven't emerged
yet.
They're
waiting
no
the day
yet.
After he's appointed Speaker.
But this is a serious Jenny, point, isn't it? That we need to see everyone's expenses before we know it. Mentors Campbell would have been an excellent choice before, but those cushions have done for him.
We're all dependent on the Daily Telegraph, which is currently running the country.
So who's your pick, Jenny?
I also think that John Bercow is amazingly interesting, given that he started off with such an appalling right-wing background. It's interesting to watch his journey over this political spectrum, and he has acquired gravitas. I'm also quite a fan of Frank Fields. I know that he's not the warmest presence, but he's got a mind like a steel trap. Polly's looking so ill, you can't imagine.
If he's in the speaker's chair, Polly, then he's kind of contained.
And it's a man who's undoubtedly going to have nothing wrong with his expenses. I mean, perhaps his only problem is that he does rather give the impression that he would rather have been a hermit in a cave, considering great
well,
issues.
Well, he does think he's a saint, but he is about the only person, certainly in the Labour Party, who thinks he's a saint. He's extraordinarily self-promoting as being better and above everybody else. He's also got
quite a
tainted record on immigration. He and Soames.
So funny.
Busy pumping out anti-immigration stuff, and I think.
But wouldn't it shut him up?
I think that's a bit unfair.
It would stir far too much hatred on Labour benches, and that's not a good start. If we actually want reform, you've got to have somebody who isn't loathed by one side of the house, and he is by his own side.
Sort of insider. And yet,
I don't think necessarily. He's got specific tribal loathing attached to him from his own side, and that's too bad a start. Burko may have the same problem on the Tory side, and that may do for him.
Interesting, we've picked the two people who both should have crossed floors. If there was going to be a prisoner swap, it would have been Field for Burko. Yeah.
I want to know why nobody is talking seriously about Anne Widdecombe. Is it again because she's just thought to be too odd?
She's going, she's leaving.
Standing, yeah. But couldn't she be persuaded to stay?
Listen, Jenny, you email Anne. Everything we're talking about is from Monday and Tuesday in the House of Commons. For PMQs yesterday, Simon Hoggart was in the press gallery watching for us.
David Cameron, the Tory leader, can't really stick it to the Labour Party on expenses. A lot of them have behaved very, very badly, but then so have very many Tories. So what David Cameron did was insist that it's time now to have an election. The Prime Minister, he said, had declared that you can't have an election because it would cause chaos. What on earth did he mean? Gordon Brown said what would cause chaos would be the election of a Conservative government, which David Cameron seized upon. He said it's the first time you've actually admitted that you might be going to lose the election. He went on and said, look, this is the fourth year of a parliament in one of the oldest democracies in the world. Why should it cause chaos? Go on, he said. Try and come up with another answer. Well, Gordon Brown was indeed in a bit of a pickle then. He seemed to be saying that because we were in a great mess with parliamentary expenses as well as the economy, it was the duty of the government to help get us out of the mess before we had any kind of election. There was chaos all around at the moment, and therefore an election could only make things worse, which is what he really meant. At which point, of course, David Cameron said, that's ridiculous, they've had elections all over the place, in India, South Africa, other places where banking crisis has been just as great as it has here. Was the United States in chaos? Was President Obama an agent of chaos? An argument went back and forth with Gordon Brown, seeming to imply in a funny way that since an election might produce the wrong result from his point of view, i.e. the election of a Conservative government, we certainly shouldn't have one. The election of a Conservative government would be a very bad thing for the country, therefore there was no reason to have an election. Also, he should be allowed to go ahead and sort out the mess we were in. He didn't, of course, admit that he had any part to play in creating the mess, but I presume that was left unsaid.
Terrible to call it chaotic, wasn't it, Polly?
Well, it was chaotic. Every Prime Minister's press question time gets worse and worse.
When he said 5 million letters are lost by Royal Mail, at which point you laugh and you say, hands up, what a mistake I made, rather than look as if it might be true.
What a blunder all the way through, and what a blunder to admit that he knows perfectly well the Conservatives are going to win the next election. What a disaster.
I don't think they are going to win the next election. I don't think they are going to win the next election.
Oh, who's going to win? Nobody. None of the above.
But the swing they need to get, they need a 7.1% swing, which only one government since the one election since the Second World War has produced, which was Blair.
But if ever there was a time to do it, it must be now. I mean, that's true, but if you look that a lot of the polls are giving them 20% leads, none of the polls are giving them less than 10 for a very long time. Labour looks as if it's on its knees, as if it's utterly crushed. Mm. I find it hard to think of any scenario by which Labour could snatch even a hung parliament, let alone a victory.
We have a leadership challenge.
You know, that kind of scenario was possible before this thing blew up, but the handling of it and the particular backlash there is against Labour. I think this is a fascinating question. We've talked about all the grandees and the moats, and yet the fury is mainly directed at Labour. There are cultural reasons for that, because in a way we expect Tories to enrich themselves. Labour, we expect on some deep level, even people who don't like Labour, to be better.
So you think this has lost them the election?
I'll make that judgment after the European elections, but I'm open to the idea that Labour may well come fourth. I think it could be an absolute pounding of the kind we haven't seen, where you see them in 15-16% territory. The only thing that might stop that is if UKIP and BNP between them split that far-right vote, and therefore that somehow lets Labour come in third. But we're in that kind of territory, so that's why to talk of landslides and wipeouts, however, whatever the precedence, is suddenly, I think, the only way you can speak.
It's really interesting, because last week in the pod, people were saying that the Tories were just as damaged. Jenny, you think...
And I think absolutely not. And I think the reason for that is precisely because of leadership. And it's not the case that Brown didn't seize the moment. What this crisis has exposed is that Brown is always incapable of seizing the moment. Mm. He is just not able to get outside that, let me think about committees and let me consider this for several weeks and let me consult everybody around me and make sure I'm not taking the wrong decision.
That's the problem the CLPs are having with his response.
And it's the problem that there has always been about Brown. I mean, some of us wrote before he took office that the great anxiety was that as people in the Treasury said, he would take a very long time to come to any decision. Of course, if you're in the Treasury, you can go into a bunker and say, I'm thinking about great ideas, and you're not required to come out there. When you're Prime Minister, you've got to decide what you're going to do and why you're going to do it. And that's what he can't do. And that is why Cameron is winning on this issue. I mean, he ought to be just as badly affected because of all the stuff we've talked about. And yet, he's very good at saying, here is where I stand on this principle. I am outraged by what's going on and I will deal with it.
I mean, he has got a sort of touch of the Thatchers with that, which is he has the brazenness to run against his own party. You know, he's been leader of it 4 years. He didn't clear up the Anthony Steens and the Douglas Hoggs. But somehow he manages to sound outraged. Thatcher used to rail against the government after she'd been Prime Minister for 11 years. He's got that same, A, the brazenness, B, he brazens it out about himself, as Polly said, about wisteria. But finally, he knows about the sort of theatrics of alpha male leadership. Thatcher was an example, Blair was, which is just to be seen to be sacking people and firm. I mean, that's what the extraordinary thing is, this expenses thing, which should have been Gordon Brown's third chance to revive from the dead, right? And now, finally, a chance where Cameron should have been on the ropes and defensive after the economic crisis, etc. He's managed to fumble it. I mean, it is an absolute indictment of Brown, unfortunately.
But don't you think some of this, some of his apparent failure is just where we are in the political cycle? I mean, Cameron gets out his chequebook and says, I'm sorry for robbing the bank,
have
a check.
He had the chance. When he stepped out and said, my moral compass, things are going to be different, change. A great sigh of relief all around the country. You suddenly thought, actually, this stolid, stodgy Chancellor figure, maybe that's a great contrast with Blair's glibness and with Cameron's slipperiness. Maybe that stuffiness is just what we need. But of course, with it came, exactly as Jenny said, gross indecision, absolutely inability to seize any kind of initiative and take the lead on anything at all. Is he a goner? What do you think?
Absolutely.
I know that you think he'll be toppled before the next election. I think that, again, depends on the European elections. If they get a sort of traumatic drubbing, I mean, below even what they've already... You know, obviously, in some ways, they've already got that in the price. They've predicted that they'll do badly. But if it's even worse than that, shockingly bad, so in the teens percentage of the vote, I think the question may reopen. But otherwise, I think he does limp on, because that's one thing he's very good at as a leader. He has a great talent in frustrating and thwarting challenges on his own side.
How can they bear a year more of this?
They won't take it.
We don't have to bear any more now because we're going to have something completely different.
Nothing the right honourable gentleman has said troubles me in the least. It doesn't even touch me. I speak for the British people. Consulted them and they have spoken. I have every reason to have every faith in the point and meaning of the proposed bill. In everything it encapsulates and everything it stands for. It doesn't surprise me in the least that the right honourable members opposite cannot stand the idea of having their lives dictated to them from somewhere like West Yorkshire. Well, get used to it! Some of us have had our lives dictated to us from London for far too long!
That was the amazing Mrs. Pritchard, the far-fetched lead character from a BBC 2006 drama.
She's no longer so far-fetched.
In which the supermarket manager got so fed up with Westminster politics that she brought about a challenge and stood as a politician.
When Tom said, and now for something completely different, that was an Esther Ranson link. That's like, just to make it obvious. Jenny, right, okay, you live in Luton. Who do you vote for, Esther Ranson or Margaret? No, she doesn't. No, I'm just...
I get a second home's allowance, Jonathan, do you know? I'm the only one with a garden. I don't live in Luton.
It is a hypothetical. Sorry. Nice, very nothing. Margaret Moran or Esther Ranson, who would you vote for?
Definitely Esther Anson.
Oh my God.
No, I tell you,
you
why.
Deserve all you
I,
get.
I know nothing about Esther Anson. I grew up without a television. I never watched This Life. I didn't recognise that link. But, and it's not Esther Anson personally I'd be voting for, but actually, I think it would be very good for the House of Commons if a whole lot of independent candidates came in who had to be convinced of the merits of the main party's arguments. It's not that you wouldn't end up with party politics. You'd still have Labour and Conservatives with manifestos and trying to get them through. But you'd actually have a bunch of people who would have to be persuaded. And we haven't had enough of that because people just trot through lobbies, often not even knowing which issue they're voting on, but just knowing the whips say go in this direction. And I think it's appalling.
Johnny? Well, if I lived in Luton, not so hypothetical, my father was born and raised in Luton, I would definitely vote for Esther Anson because I would want to send this message to punish this political class. But that just shows you the limitations of our system, because we know that's a bad option, voting for somebody like her. But because
why would it be a bad option? Because she can go in and have an intelligent voting issue. She wouldn't vote for the Iraq War.
You're right, I shouldn't have taken that for granted. What I mean by we know that's a bad option. If you vote for an independent, as people in Kidderminster, Wyre Forest discovered, you have somebody who in the end is bound to be powerless because independents can't form a majority, can't
but
form a government.
But ordinary MPs are completely
And they
powerless.
Even have limited powers of scrutiny
but
because of committees, etc. Let me just complete the point. In the PR, then you can vote exactly your preference. And so you could have a block of people who are exactly where you are. They're either green or they're on the right wing or wherever, or even independents, a block of independents. That becomes meaningful. But it's very difficult with these one-off candidates. I mean, even voters in Taff and Martin Bell, what a great guy. Good man, but in the end, he was very limited in what he could achieve. And that's a flaw in our system, not in them.
Polly is looking at the ceiling, sighing.
There is such a danger in this anti-politics movement.
I agree.
In the end, there is left and there is right. And when you vote for someone, you damn well need to know where they stand. And you might say, oh, you know, lovely Esther Anson used to like her. I have not a clue what she thinks about social security.
She hasn't got a clue.
I wouldn't know.
Not to say that she's not a clever woman.
She wouldn't. You would never know where she would vote on really important things. And, you know, it's all very well saying they're overwhipped. They are. But on the other hand, most people go and vote. They haven't a clue who their MP is or what they stand for, but they get a general idea of what Labour is and what the Tories are and what the Lib Dems are, and that's what they vote for. If you have a whole array of celebs chosen for maybe one issue, like Gurkhas or whatever, you're never going to know what they'll actually do on the things that really matter, on taxes, on foreign policy, on spending, on the things that are the stuff of politics. And I'm very, very alarmed that we're losing the idea that there are real decisions to be made and a real difference.
But there's a distinction.
That's their fault. I mean, but with the expenses thing, in this particular moment, if it's Margaret Moran or Esther Anson, I think even you, nose peg and all, would have to say Esther Anson in that choice, because otherwise you're saying to them, you know what, you can just keep bilking the public purse, you can keep taking our money, and we're still going to re-elect you.
But isn't the distinction that Esther is a celeb, whereas if we had an independent that was a councillor or somebody who had come to politics for sort of vainglorious elements of it, that one could support them more easily?
I'm glad you mentioned councillors, because there are a lot of councillors who are independents around the country. They nearly all turn out to be Tories. The thing is, if you say, I'm not political, it's almost a guarantee you're a Tory. That is the way it always goes.
Go on, Jenny.
You could have all kinds of opinions. You could have all kinds of left-wing opinions and not be part of the Labour Party machine. And when I look at some of the shameful things that this government has voted through, things like ID cards or Trident, or all kinds of issues that I didn't support, like student tuition fees, I don't think you can argue that you get fantastic politics out of getting
a
party slate in. And lots of them were not in the manifesto.
Exactly. I was going to say, nor can you argue that you knew what you were getting. Because I think very few Labour voters in the 2001 election thought they were going to elect somebody who will stand shoulder to shoulder with the neocon president.
Or privatise the post office.
You know, no. So I think that is a breakdown, again, in our system. I think what's interesting about the amazing Mrs Pritchard,
though... True, but the answer is we've got to put the system right, not to have a whole lot of complete mavericks. We haven't approved what you're voting for.
We're 20 independents.
You might as well pick them by lottery out of the elevators, which might be
but
better.
Polly, would 20 independents be a new breed be the moment at which you then get the new system? How much are they the sort of
because you're not going to get PR before the next election. So at the moment, if you're just standing and you've got the two candidates in Luton, why not have a handful of independents in Parliament
and
ginger things up?
It does show what a very blunt instrument our ballot is at the moment under our system. It's so crude that you end up with these very full, very disappointing, depressing choices. I want to say something about the amazing Mrs Pritchard, though, because why is that so
appealing?
You love her. No, I mean, but I found it appealing in a way like a lot of other people did. stupid. I mean, why is it appealing? It's the notion that somebody completely from who's not part of this club can suddenly come through. Now, in our system, that is really not a possibility. And it used to be a possibility with local government. When there was very strong local government, you could be a leader in your town or city. And then, you know, there are all the examples, Joseph Chamberlain in Birmingham and more recently David Blunkett in Sheffield. That route does seem to be closed. Shockingly, a cabinet minister told a few of us this week that he cannot name the most a new entrant to the cabinet in years who wasn't first a special advisor. And the same is true of the Tory front bench. They're this incredibly narrow group. I mean, the thick of it and In the Loop captures these sort of nerdy guys in Westminster who work for a front bencher, then become a cabinet minister. These are not the big figures that we knew of about politics even 25 years
ago. And they're street fighters as well.
And you need people
who
come through, and local government, the localisation of British politics, will lead to some Mrs. Pritchards coming through.
That is a positive, and our producers just asked us to end on a positive. That is all for this week's edition of Politics Weekly.
Many thanks to our panel, so Polly Toynbee, Jenny Russell and Jonathan Friedland. Your thoughts are greatly appreciated, so do put them on the Politics website, or you can also look towards a better tomorrow on Comment is Free at the moment, where we're all blue skies thinking about what a new politics might look like.
Politics Weekly was produced by Peter Sale and Ben Green. We'll be back next week.
And goodbye.